ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For years, art buyers have been told the same thing.
He was an internationally acclaimed artist
whose work is available in Australia through only one gallery.
His works were selling really well.
But workers start to notice something unusual.
He's not contactable by any means.
They couldn't find any presence of him online.
In Search of the Missing Artist, a new three-part series that investigates the strange business of making art. Search Background Briefing wherever you get your podcasts.
A dangerous time for the global economy. That's the dire warning from Treasurer Jim Chalmers as the International Monetary Fund cautions a global recession could be on the table. It comes as the Treasurer heads to the US for a key meeting with international counterparts, pushing for an enduring end to the war and holding bilateral talks to secure more fuel supply. And the opposition has been under pressure to clarify key elements of its newly unveiled immigration policy. So, do the details go beyond slogans? And, well, how many details are there? Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelas.
And I'm David Spears.
And David, a sobering assessment from the IMF today, warning the war in the Middle East has turned the world upside down. In its World Economic Outlook report, the IMF has forecast three scenarios that get worse depending on how long energy supplies are disrupted. If the war ends quickly, the damage will be limited. But if it continues, the IMF's severe scenario has a global recession as a live option. It is very dire, David. How is our government responding to it?
Yeah, look, it's not great, this outlook from the IMF. I don't think it's particularly surprising, given we are where we are. You're right, there are three scenarios put forward, in simple terms, bad, worse, and terrible. You're right, the worst case scenario does see global growth fall close to recession, so 2% growth. It points out, though, the IMF's chief economist, that that would feel like a recession for many countries, and presumably many countries would actually be in a recession. You have very high unemployment and so on. And for Australia, it's saying the base case is for growth slowing to 2% this year, 1.7% next year, so a little worse next year, and inflation is the big problem for Australia. Already one of the highest. It would hit 4% this year and ease off to 3.2% next year. Look, I think, to be honest, PK, I don't know about you, but with so much uncertainty and volatility, I'm just not sure how much we really should read into any forecast right now, be they from the IMF, from Treasury, from the Reserve Bank. Things are moving so fast. They're so unpredictable. Like you, I'm sure you wake up each morning, see what Donald Trump has said, what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz. It's just so hard to know where things are going to go tomorrow, let alone, you know, this time next year. These sort of forecasts, I think you've got to take with a big grain of salt. But I do think we all know this is hurting and will continue to get worse until oil starts flowing again.
I think that's right. And you're right. We wake up every day, see what Donald Trump's had to say. I mean, this is a man who's currently having a public fight with the Pope. So, I mean, a man who thinks taking on the Pope is a normal thing to do, in all seriousness, is not somebody that you can sort of wake up and think, what predictable de-escalatory approach will be taken today by this man? He knows how dire the world economy, the situation it's in. It doesn't seem to me he's overly concerned. I think he's got other priorities, and this is, we are at his whim. This is our problem. We're currently creating a budget in, I don't even know why they're bothering in some ways, like, just hold off, guys. Like, really, like, what they have, it's contingency. You know what, I'm exaggerating to make a point.
Sure. But it's hard to make the forecast in this budget. How do you do it?
What are you doing?
I don't know. I mean, maybe things settle down in the next 3-4 weeks before this budget is due. Well, in fact, it's less than 4 weeks now. But you'd have to say that's very hard to see. The level of frustration in the Australian government is going up and up and up each week of this. You know, whether it was Trump threatening to wipe out a civilization, this week having a go at the Pope, posing as Jesus, or a doctor, as he later...
A doctor, yeah. It looked like a doctor, didn't it?
Sure did. The level of frustration I'm picking up within the Australian government is quite, well, it's quite something. It's not something I've witnessed before when it comes to a US government and its actions that a US president is taking. And you know, it's not just Trump. Scott Bessent, the Secretary of the Treasury over there, has just said overnight our time about, you know, these IMF warnings and what's happening with the global economy. Let me read you what he said to reporters, PK. "I wonder what the hit would be to global GDP if a nuclear weapon hit London. I think a small bit of economic pain for a few weeks is worth the taking off the incalculable tail risk of a nuclear Iran." So there you go, PK. We should all stop whinging. At least we're not seeing Iran drop a nuclear bomb on London. I think this line about a small bit of economic pain for a few weeks has really gone down like a lead balloon here, and I'm sure in other countries that are being rocked by what's happening to their economies.
And our friends at ABC Business Daily are digging deeper into the numbers and the raw economics of the IMF's warnings. So check their latest podcast if you want to know more. But back to the politics. Treasurer Jim Chalmers off to the US for a G20 meeting with international counterparts. These are kind of happen always around this time before the budget. And there's always a lot of weight on how he comes back and the framing from those meetings, wouldn't you say, around the kind of indications he gets about where it's going. Although, I mean, this is again, I know, I hate to labour the point, but we've also got, you know, clearly J.D. Vance or his surrogates leaking to the New York Times his disagreement on the war. So I don't know. It depends who Jim Chalmers speaks to, right? Like, will he get a real steer on where this is going or what it means? He's warned that this is a really dangerous time for the global economy. I think it fits into a pre-existing and in some ways none of this is helpful, don't get me wrong, but the government already had an inflation problem. It is leaning into this crisis to kind of prepare and set expectations about what Australians should expect and to in some ways lower their expectations that they're about to, you know, get hit by a really happy budget. I don't think it's going to be a particularly happy budget for anyone. He's done his usual line, which I want to sort of interrogate if we can, that Australia is better placed and better prepared than most, but won't be spared the fallout. I don't know. Are we?
Well, in a growth...
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, in an economic growth sense, we are, but in an inflation sense, we're not. So we've got one of the higher inflation rates heading into this, but one of the better growth rates. So it's a bit of, you know, on the one hand, on the other. Look, I think you can sense, you can see that Jim Chalmers is incredibly frustrated by what all of this is doing to his plans for what was meant to be a big reforming budget. His language about this war and the US is stronger than the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister has been saying for a couple of weeks now, we need to de-escalate, we need to de-escalate, we need to de-escalate. Jim Chalmers, you listen to what he said this morning on radio and talking to reporters at the airport before he jetted off to Washington. He said, Australians didn't choose the circumstances of that war, but they are paying a very hefty price for it. We need to see an end to the war. We need to see the Strait of Hormuz properly open. And he's repeating this. We need to see an end to the war. My understanding is this is coordinated, that he's going to lean in more than the foreign minister and the prime minister with some of this language as the, you know, the lead economic minister dealing with the real pain that Australia is having to cop as a result of this war. He's going harder in his language. He will meet Scott Bessent. He'll meet a bunch of others while he's on the ground for, I think, less than 24 hours in the US for the IMF and World Bank meetings. But it's clear that frustration that Australia is feeling is being vented by our treasurer, Jim Chalmers. What does it mean for the budget? Well, again, his messages before he took off, it's not going to be an identical budget to what we were planning before the war back in February. But I think he's indicating that he still wants this to be a reforming budget. Sure, they've got to deal with the immediate pressures of fuel security. And no doubt there'll be, you know, more announcements in the budget around what they can do about fuel security. But he's indicating he still wants to do the housing stuff, the intergenerational inequity that he keeps talking about. That's capital gains tax, negative gearing reform that they were already planning. He still wants to do that. That was my interpretation of it anyway.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it was only a couple of weeks ago, of course, that the Prime Minister spoke at the National Press Club and said that this crisis will not stop him from moving to having the most reforming budget. So We don't seem to have what has been in the last few budgets, perhaps, maybe I'm using the word too strong a word, but a split between the Prime Minister and the Treasurer, I think, has existed in the past on this.
Yeah, I don't see that at the moment. I think that's right. I think they both are sending the same signal about the need to still, despite, you know, the difficulty, more than difficulty, that this war is creating for them, they still want to do that reform. And I think, you know, we can explore in, you know, other conversations the reasons why, not just budget reasons, but political reasons on intergenerational inequity. And both, I think, Chalmers and Albanese have spoken about this in a political sense as well. The fracturing that you see between the generations, what that can lead to in you know, the political landscape, as we've seen around the country, they want to avoid that by offering this move on those housing taxes.
So the Prime Minister is on this Asian trip trying to shore up our fuel supplies. We're recording this kind of middle of the day on a Wednesday. Chris Bowen's about to stand up and give some more detail about us, you know, securing more fuel into the country, is my understanding, which is something obviously that they announced that they would bankroll or finance, you know, some pretty expensive fuel into the country, some progress on that. So all of that is front of mind for the government, being able to answer consistently and assure Australians that they're on top of that part of the crisis. They can't fix the world economy, but they can ensure our country keeps functioning. But we will see shortages. It's inevitable. And so it's already having an impact on business confidence, right? It's kind of smashing the economy. Like, anecdotally, David, I speak to many people who run businesses and things are falling off a cliff for people.
Yeah.
Like, it's really noticeable that there's been a shift in behaviour. And I think we're going to get into some difficult territory. The Treasury wanted to deliver what was more of an austerity budget with reform, right? Are we going to be in a month in a situation where they may need to stimulate? Like, I mean, things are moving that fast. Don't rule it out.
This is the great difficulty of this budget. You know, government ministers are sending out signals about more cost of living help in the budget. But, you know, if they're not offsetting that with spending cuts elsewhere, that risks being inflationary. So this is the difficulty. Look, there's no doubt, as Chris Richardson and others have pointed out, the benefit, I suppose, in a financial sense of, or a budget sense of what's going on, the higher commodity prices will help revenue surge into budget coffers. You'd think they'd be banking all or as much of that as possible. Any cost of living help would still need to be offset, not to be inflationary. So, yeah, it does get very complicated, very difficult for them. I do think, though, in terms of the Strait of Hormuz, I think there's a really interesting question just to keep an eye on. And it's one that you were asking Pat Conroy about a couple of days ago on Afternoon Briefing. Will Australia contribute to this US blockade? Now, Pat Conroy, Defence Industry Minister, said to you, you asked him five or six times, and he was very clear. It was good to press him, because he kept saying, no, we're not considering joining the blockade. He didn't want to get into your questions around why. But it was an adamant position. You know, he said it over and over again. No, we're not considering joining the blockade. That was 2 days ago. And I know the UK and France had said similar at that point. But I just wonder, PK, I'm picking up a few mixed signals now within government about whether that is still a hardline no, or whether they are now considering, depending on how this goes. You're just hearing a lot more sensible voices beyond the Trump administration saying, look, we may not have agreed with the decision to go to war. We might have thought it was a terrible idea, but we are where we are. And is a blockade like this going to put the pressure on to prevent Iran having control over the Strait of Hormuz? I just think it's just one to mark, one to keep an eye on to see where Australia goes on this.
That's really,
I don't think we'd
really
send a shift, to be clear, but whether we provide some sort of support in some way is, I think, a bit of a question mark at the moment.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I want to move, if we can, to the fallout from the big announcement from the Coalition on immigration, this long-awaited policy. Now, yesterday, Tom Crowley and I kind of tried to bring you our hot takes on what they were trying to do.
More than hot takes. That was an excellent analysis, I thought. It was very good.
Is it One Nation light? is it, you know, there's some genuine good ideas here? Tried to work it out. So yesterday, of course, opposition leader Angus Taylor unveiled what is the first pillar. There has to be more. We don't know the number, for instance. He says he wants it to be lower, but they haven't announced any number on the immigration level. So what we know, though, is that there's a lot that we don't know. That's the conclusion I want to come to. Like, for instance, there will be behaviours which constitute a breach of Australian values under the opposition's proposal. So I tried to get to the bottom of this. Others have tried to. Jane Hume is, of course, the deputy leader of the Liberal Party. She was on Afternoon Briefing with me. I tried to find out from her what behaviours, if you'd been against gay people. And the reason I use that is I happen to be gay. That's not why I asked, actually. I just want to full, because a few people have trolled me about this. No, it's because every time I speak to a right-wing politician now, they go on about that, you know, some of these people believe in killing gays, right? And I'm like, okay, so if you say something that's anti-gay, does that mean on your social media, does that mean you don't get access to a visa? Well, no, I don't think, David, that's quite it. I mean, do we know?
You're demanding a lot of detail from a policy that is really about the signal that it sends, right? PK, there's a by-election coming up in 24 days, three and a bit weeks. So, look, even though the world's gripped by this crisis in the Middle East, soaring petrol prices, fears of recession, Angus Taylor is looking at that by-election. He's not putting forward, you know, plans on national resilience or tax reform to better prepare Australia for what's ahead right now. His priority is winning back as many voters as he can who've drifted from the Libs to One Nation. And he has 3 weeks to do it. So he's pulled the immigration lever. It's a signal that he's sending as loudly as he can that he will be tougher in protecting Australian values. Now, yes, there are still a lot of questions around the detail. How would this be different to, you know, the current very broad godlike power the immigration minister has to cancel someone's visa on character grounds? It would basically be the coalition taking a more active approach, exercising that lever, you know, far more. And Taylor's line, we will discriminate based on values, not based on race or religion or the nation they're coming from. This focus on values, it's not, PK, particularly original for leaders on the right to send that signal that they are going to discriminate on values. Just a quick check, I can tell you Nigel Farage in the UK talks about British values. The recently defeated Viktor Orban in Hungary talked a lot about Christian values. The Dutch far-right politician Geert Wilders says migrants must adopt our values. So it's values, values, values. This is a shift in language so that we're not talking about race, discriminating on race. It's kind of a shift to say we're discriminating on values, our way of life. So it is consistent with what we've seen from right-wing politicians around the world. The detail of how you would do that, yeah, they've become a little bit, well, it's the detail is still lacking to a degree.
It is, because they talk about sort of legislating, putting into the Migration Act these values. Now, the minister already has the power, if you're on a visa, to actually kick you out of the country on the basis of character, right?
It's like, very broad. Yeah, this is Section 501 of the Migration Act. They can cancel a visa if the minister reasonably suspects a person fails the test and they are satisfied the cancellation is in the national interest. That old national interest. It's such a broad umbrella. Mm. Yep.
So it can happen. Now, the coalition's answer to what is a very reasonable question that's been put to them is, well, this codifies it. It's broader. It embeds it in the law. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to give you an analysis if that's true. But I know many people contest whether that is actually the way it will apply. So again, back to your original point, it is clearly about sending a signal.
And that might work. That might work. I mean, you know.
Will it?
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, I know a lot of people have said, oh, look, you can't outflank One Nation on this stuff. Sure. But there are people who are drifting in the middle, might be between the Libs and One Nation, who just want to hear a harder line on immigration, but don't want to go with Pauline Hanson and the, you know, some of the elements of that party. So maybe it works. I don't know. We'll see in a few weeks.
We won't know if it works, and we won't know just from the Farah by-election either, right? Like, it's a slow burn with a policy like this. It's the old vomit principle, repeat, 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 see if people think it sounds good for them. I'll tell you where it may not work. Because of how many questions there are And because of some of the Trumpy sounding elements, now today they've been keen, people like John O'Donoghue, to say, no, it won't sort of police speech. Remember, the Liberal Party, big believers, at least historically, in freedom of speech. I can just see this being potentially really exploited in a potential scare campaign by a smart and good machine-like Labor operation, you know, like the whole kind of, are they going to take your grandma, like the ICE agents on the street? Like, you could really go to town with some of this. There are gaping holes. You would, if you were a smart political operator, and they've got some pretty smart political operators on their side, you would be, there are the gaping holes and lack of detail provides you, my friend, with a real opportunity potentially. And I'm a little surprised they've allowed themselves to be in that zone, yeah? Do you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. I think they do need to be careful around some of the lines, like, you know, some migrants are a drain on society or on Australia.
Lifters, leaners, drainers.
That sort of language, yeah, can absolutely be weaponised in metropolitan seats with high numbers of migrants, no question. Again, just coming back to the by-election, though, the Libs aren't fighting Labor in this by-election. You're right down the track, they will be fighting Labor at the general election.
If they want to win a general election.
Sure. But right now, I just really can't stress how important this is for Angus Taylor and the Liberal Party. If they are beaten by One Nation, which they may well be, according to some of the polling that's been done, this is going to be a really, really bad period for all of them, right? They replaced Susan Lee on the grounds that they were losing too much support to One Nation. They put in Angus Taylor to try and fix the job. He needs to perform in Farrah, and that's the focus. It's not Labor right now.
Yeah, I think that you're dead right, but I do think it's worth mentioning that, yes, that's the next hurdle, and obviously the next hurdle in politics is always the one anyone focuses on. But man,
there's a bigger fight coming.
If they don't work out a broader strategy for actually winning a power, then they are going to be in a world of hurt for a lot longer than one by-election. And this is the broader conundrum they have. On that question, though, I think it's a really interesting point you make, and I think it's absolutely true that there will be scrutiny on Angus Taylor. But I don't feel like anyone's setting it up other than the media. Am I missing something as a, you know, do or die moment for him?
I think that's right. I don't think, you know, they lose the by-election and they roll the leader. They've just done that. So I don't think we're in that scenario. But I do think the chatter around Andrew Hastie in particular, and, you know, then there'd be others, but I think it's daylight after Andrew Hastie, at some point before the next election, if they are still, you know, bouncing along the bottom of the polls, well below One Nation, yeah, the leadership issue you'd think would come up again. We've still got, 2 years to go? That's a long time to be bouncing around the bottom. That's why he needs to start lifting the Liberals' support at the by-election, in the polls. You've seen this a million times. It really counts. And that leadership chatter never goes away when you're an opposition leader struggling in the polls. It never goes away.
I think I absolutely agree with that. I think that in the longer term, yeah, it's absolutely at play. And Angus Taylor's reason for actually gaining the leadership was basically, I'm going to get back those votes that are going to the One Nation column. They were pretty blunt about it. James Patterson said to me on Four Corners really bluntly, you know, this is about the voters we're losing on the right. You know, that Operation Angus was really shoring up the conservative base voters. So if he can't do that, right, that, not the general stuff, just that bit, then it's the wrong conservative candidate.
Exactly.
Right?
It's the first test. It's the big test. And yeah, I mean, we can't put everything on Farrah, but, you know, it's a lot more meaningful than an opinion poll, right?
Yeah, because it's actually a real vote.
It's a real election. So I think it does carry a lot of weight for the party.
That's it for politics now for today. David, you'll be back in the feed on Saturday for Insiders on Background. A little birdie tells me you've already locked in your guest. Is that true?
Yes, we have, which isn't always the case on a Wednesday. But Kim Beazley, the former Labor leader and, of course, renowned former defence minister, will be joining us.
Should we tell them what his nickname was?
Bomber.
Yeah. That's his nickname. So that gives you a sort of sense, doesn't
it? No, exactly. But look, I'm just really interested to hear his thoughts because tomorrow, Thursday, the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, is going to be outlining the latest Defence Strategic Plan. And in the context of this war that's going on, we've already heard a bit this week from Richard Marles about spending billions more on drones and so on. Just really interested to hear from a big picture thinker like Kim Beazley this week.
Yeah, very interesting. Big figure in the Labor Party. What are they? Often people in the Labor movement will say it's the best Prime Minister we never had. So, yeah, just important thing to remember there. Tomorrow, Jacob Greber and I will be joined by Peter Harcher for the Party Room. If you've got a question for us, send a short voice note to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. And don't forget, tickets to our free 10-year anniversary live show are in the show notes. If you want to come along, if you happen to be in Sydney, either as a Sydney-sider or as a visitor at the same time, what a coinky-dinky. I reckon that's a good coincidence. See you, David.
See you, Peter.